Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Iran has been maligned by the Western world for some 2,500 years, dating all the way back to the Greco-Persian Wars. But the history of Iran is a very important one and instructive for understanding our world today. This is where you get the first global empire incorporating many people, and in return you also get some of the first treatises on human rights. Never mind the beginnings of a postal system that we could trace our postal system today all the way back to. For this conversation, I'm joined by Reza Zarghami. Reza Zarghami is the author of the book, Discovering Cyrus, the Persian Conqueror Astride the Ancient World. Reza Zarghami, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program. Let's begin by talking about what you think is important to know, to understand about ancient Persia.
Well, If you think back to that period, and this is the 6th and the 5th and the 4th centuries BC, that period is relevant in the West and the Western historical tradition, mainly because the roots of democracy lie there. And democracy is obviously a very important socio-political issue today. But there's also another important socio-political issue, and that's globalism. And what I mean by that is the bringing together of ethnically diverse peoples, peoples with different religious beliefs, and knitting them together in an overarching global society. And the first serious move toward globalism, in my opinion at least, occurred with the Persian Empire. And that was the empire that was founded by Cyrus the Great, who's the subject of this book.
The Persian Empire, I think we often equate with modern-day Iran. Same borders? Was the Persian Empire bigger?
Well, the Persian Empire was much bigger. The Persian Empire was, at its height, somewhere between 2.5 million to 3 million square miles. So you're talking about something the size of the United States. It extended all the way from India, western and northwestern India, all the way to the Aegean Sea, from the southern frontiers of Egypt and the Sudan all the way to Central Asia, at various times parts of Europe, as far north as the Danube River were subject to it, parts of the Arabian Peninsula, and then it also controlled major waterways as
well. Was this all at one time?
It reached its height during the reign of Darius I, who was Cyrus's son-in-law, and then also his successor, the early part of the reign of Xerxes I.
So, you talk about globalism. It also brought, which could be considered one of the Persian Empire's gift to the West, administration.
Absolutely, absolutely. The Persians had a talent at that relative to other previous empire masters, if you would. They built upon the administrative systems of their predecessors. But what happened, and this really goes to Cyrus's genius, was that he had a good pulse, I feel, for the times. And, you know, before the Persians, there had been the Assyrians, who controlled a very large empire. Not as large as the Persian Empire, but vast nevertheless. And the Assyrians maintained their foreign subjects. They kept them in line through calculated acts of violence. Persian rule was, in comparison to this, relatively easygoing. Nations were free to live according to their own laws. And so the Persian Empire, in terms of its administration, was very good. I mean, it had a system. It operated almost like a federalism. You had the king and the high-level bureaucracy at the highest level, and then they managed relations with the different social elites, if you would, among the various subject nations, of which we hear in the Old Testament that there were 127 nations that formed part of this vast empire.
And it had a postal system.
Yes, it did. It did. And it had a very interesting network. It had a very vast network of roads and a very sophisticated postal system. It operated like the Pony Express. The messengers would ride and they would transport the news in relays, if you would. And archaeologists have recently found actually interesting documents relating to reimbursements for some of these messengers who were very much like government employees like you have today. But the according to Herodotus, who's the Greek historian, that motto that you see in the U.S. postal system actually comes from Herodotus' description of the ancient Persian courier system.
The motto, rain or shine.
Exactly. It's something like neither heat nor darkness nor cold nor gloom will prevent these riders from relaying their dispatch in the fastest time possible. Something along that line. I know I butchered the quote, but
but that comes from Herodotus' account of the Persian Empire.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he mentions it in context of when Xerxes captures Athens he sends messengers back to his capital at Susa, which was in what's now southwestern Iran near the border with Iraq, and he uses that description to describe how fast the news got back to the Middle East.
And Herodotus is considered the father of history.
Absolutely.
I mean, I don't know how accurate that actually would be, but that's the name he is given.
Well,
tell me about who was Herodotus.
Well, Herodotus was, I think it's a very apt name for him. He was the father of history. You know, before Herodotus came, there was a huge tendency among the Greeks to mix history with legend. So, for example, the Iliad and the Odyssey, I use those as examples. I mean, these are works of epic poetry, legends, if you would. But Greeks at that time viewed them very much as history. With Herodotus, you begin to see the shift toward a more empirical study of history. Also, the use of history, you know, really trying to grasp lessons from it to direct people in the future. And Herodotus has an interesting story himself. He was born in Halicarnassus around 485 BC. Halicarnassus was a city. It was a Greek colony, but it was in Asia Minor in what's today Turkey. It's the present-day city of Bodrum, as a matter of fact. So he was born actually a subject and a citizen, if you would, of the Persian Empire. But of course, his cultural...
He was a subject of the Persian Empire.
Yeah, that's
he was oftentimes associated as being part
well,
of
he
Greek.
Was of Greek. He was definitely of Greek ancestry, but at that time the Persians ruled over many of the Greeks, certainly the Greeks of Asia. And then, so he had a very interesting perspective. He himself was Greek, and it's very obvious when you read his work that his heart lies with the Greeks, but at the same time he does have a respect and an insight on the Persian Empire because, again, he was born a member, a subject of that empire.
Did he see himself as a subject of that empire?
No, I mean,
I don't know if we would. I don't know if we can compare the way we see nationality today as they would see themselves.
I think that's correct. Although again, with Herodotus, you begin. You know, Herodotus gives his account of the wars waged by the Persians against the Greeks, and he draws a distinction between the Hellenes, or the Greeks, and then the barbarians, who include the Persians and, you know, essentially all foreigners. So
he saw the Persians as barbarians?
Yes, but the term barbarian didn't have that connotation at that time that we have.
You're talking about a direct link to the word itself, barbarian.
Right, exactly. I mean, it just meant someone that spoke a non-Greek language. It didn't have that connotation necessarily of being civil, culturally backward, if you would. But Herodotus, I think, had a very interesting perspective, and he had a lot of respect for the Persians in particular, and for Cyrus especially. And in fact, he closes out his histories with one of the wise proverbs of Cyrus, which is that soft lands breed soft men. It is not the property of a single soil to produce fine soldiers and good fruits too. And the moral of that is that the Athenians, and that was the Herodotus' audience at the time, they had been accruing a lot of wealth and a lot of power, and Herodotus wrote that as an admonition that they shouldn't become too complacent and too luxury loving.
Well, as we move to talk about Cyrus, what's fascinating in following up on Herodotus here is that, just a couple of hundred years ago, people in Iran didn't even know who Cyrus the Great was.
Exactly, and that's one of the ironies of his history is that he had this stellar reputation among the Iranians of his own day. In fact, Herodotus tells us that the Persians called him the father because he was kind and he wanted to provide all good things for him. And he also, elsewhere in the histories, he mentions that Darius once wanted to praise one of his officers, and he says he was the greatest Persian except for Cyrus, with whom no Persian can dare compare himself. But what happened was that because the Persians did not keep their history in a written form that has survived to the present. They're very good at keeping records for administrative purposes, but narrative history, again, was a foreign concept to them, really. And even the inscriptions of their kings don't provide detailed accounts. They're more ideological statements. And so
I remember we were talking about having a postal system. The notes that they would write, those did not survive, or those never?
Those have survived. Uh-huh. It's almost like the receipts or the invoices or the government records of business, that day-to-day business that had to be done, that has survived. Disbursements, for example, from the royal treasury, That has survived. But in terms of this king in year one, he went and he, for example, he invaded this country or there was a rebellion here and the king quashed it. There's only one inscription of note that covers subject matter and that of that type. And that was put up by Darius the First.
Uh-huh.
So with respect to Cyrus, there's nothing of the sort. There were, however, the Cyrus legends. These were popular stories based on folklore that were disseminated at the time of Cyrus and his successors. They were modeled after pre-existing legends from the Iranian epics. And I suspect that that's one of the key reasons as to why Cyrus lost his place in history, that at some point in the future, after the fall of his empire, when the language and the script had changed, these stories may have nevertheless survived. And there was an effort made, we know, around the first century AD to compile these stories and come up with a cohesive narrative of Iran's history. This would have been an oral narrative, of course. And they may have seen that the stories of Cyrus bear such a strong resemblance to the stories of some of these epic heroes that they concluded that they're one and the same person, but they did not retain Cyrus's name. They retained the name of the epic hero.
What was or what is Iranian epic story?
Well, the most famous compilation of these epics is the Shahnameh of Ferdowsi. That was written in 1000 AD. But many of these stories we know from other texts, including the Zoroastrian scriptures, they go back to the time of Cyrus, if not before. And there's a strong resemblance between some of these stories and some of the very well-known Western myths and legends, such as, for example, the myth of Romulus, the founder of Rome, the motif of a canine or a wild dog finding an abandoned child who's destined for greatness and giving it milk. And there's a reason for this similarity, because all these legends go back to a common Indo-European heritage. The Iranians, the Persians, the Medes, these are different Iranian peoples. And the Iranians in turn were an Indo-European people, as were the ancestors of the Greeks and as were the ancestors of the Latins. And so all these different groups had very similar myths and very similar legends.
What is meant by Indo-European?
Well, the Indo-Europeans were speakers of dialects and languages that were related. And, these languages and dialects have been attested as far east as India and as far west as Europe. So representative examples would include in the east, Sanskrit, for example, is an Indo-European language, as is Farsi or Persian, Old Persian, which is the grandfather language of Persian. It was the language spoken in Iran at the time of Cyrus the Great, but also Greek, also Latin, and then from Latin, the Romance languages.
Again, we are in conversation with Reza Zarghami, who's now really giving us a lesson in the classics. He is the author of the book, Discovering Cyrus the Persian Conqueror Astride the Ancient World. I think my peppering you of questions prevented us to get to how did Iran then discover Cyrus the Great? How did they find out about this?
How did they rediscover him?
Rediscover him.
Well, really through the works of Western scholars, European and American scholars, beginning in the 19th century. And then it really picked up during the 20th century. At that time, there was the Pahlavi regime, which ruled Iran from 1926 to 1979. They were overthrown at the time of the Islamic Revolution. And for ideological purposes, they looked back to the glory days of Iran as they knew it from, again, the Western scholarship, which was the time of Cyrus when the Persians had this vast empire. And in fact, in 1971, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the last Shah of Iran, he threw a ceremony at Persepolis to celebrate 25 centuries of Iranian monarchy. And there was this famous parade where they brought, he dressed up soldiers of his own army in the costume of all the different, from all the different periods, all the different dynasties. But the focal point really was the glorification of the Achaemenids. That's the dynasty of kings to which Cyrus belonged. And in fact, the kickoff to the ceremonies, the Shah himself went to the tomb of Cyrus. And he has this famous quote where he says, "Cyrus, sleep easy because I am awake." And then, of course, 8 years later, he was overthrown.
How did the clerical leadership in 1979 view Cyrus the Great, and do they still? How do they view them? How do they view him today?
Well, I wasn't, I was a child, so I can't speak about this firsthand. And I hear news that comes out of Iran. And of course, one thing I have to say is that often people who come out of Iran, if they do so because you know, they've had a troubling experience, they might go a little bit overboard in you know, what they have to say about the regime. But my understanding is that initially, after the revolution, they frowned upon anything that had a monarchical connotation. And of course, Cyrus instituted absolute monarchy in Iran. He ruled as an absolute monarchy. So at first, I don't think they had a positive impression of him at all. And this was, of course, accentuated because of the fact that the Shah, the last Shah, whom they had overthrown, looked up to Cyrus so much and tried to draw some sort of an ideological connection between his own rule and that of Cyrus. But my understanding is that at the moment, this is, you know, the temper has come down, if you would. A few years ago, the Cyrus cylinder, which is the most iconic artifact from Cyrus's reign, it was an inscription inscribed, composed in Babylonia after Cyrus conquered that land. It's on permanent. This artifact is on permanent display in the British Museum. But several years ago, it went to Iran. It was loaned to the Archaeological Museum of Iran in Tehran, and several hundreds of thousands of people went to go see it. So I think right now the issue of Cyrus is not sensitive per se in the Islamic Republic.
Was it sensitive at one time because Cyrus the Great was rediscovered in Iran through Western academics?
Well, I don't think it had to do because of the fact that he was discovered in Iran through the work of Western academics per se. But what I would say is this, because he was discovered as a result of scholarship composed primarily initially outside of Iran, he did not have a place within the Islamic historical canon. I mean, he lived and he reigned 11 centuries before Islam came to Iran. So he didn't have a place in that historical canon. And moreover, he was associated, he may have been associated with the last Shah of Iran. So
that's why, problematic.
Right, exactly. Could be problematic.
He was a major, he does play a major role, Cyrus the Great, perhaps not in the Islamic canon, but in the Bible.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He is called in the book of Isaiah. There's an anonymous prophet known as 2nd Isaiah, and he refers to Cyrus as the Messiah, or the Lord's anointed, the legitimate king of Israel. He's the only Gentile to receive that title.
The king of Israel.
Yes. And that's because in the 6th century BC, about 45 years before Cyrus conquered the Babylonian Empire, and at that time the Babylonians ruled over the Hebrews and the Jews, the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar II had destroyed the city of Jerusalem. He had sacked the temple of Yahweh, which was the nerve center of the Jewish religion, and he had exiled perhaps as many as 20,000 Jews into Babylonian captivity. And in the buildup of his invasion of Babylon in 539, Cyrus established contacts with the leaders of this Jewish community living in exile, and he promised them reparations. He said that if he were to be victorious, he would allow them to rebuild their temple and he would repatriate them to their homeland. And this is exactly what he did. And so the Jews held him in very high regard. And again, going back to the point you mentioned earlier, within Iran, it was primarily the Jewish and the Christian minorities that remembered the name of Cyrus up until recent times.
And so do we know of Cyrus the Great today because of, and maybe we'll talk what we've discovered in Iran since, but because both of Herodotus and the Old Testament?
They're two of the most important sources on him.
Are they independent sources on him?
They're absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Those are two of the most important sources. You also have a fair amount of documentation from Babylonia. The Cyrus cylinder itself is an artifact that was discovered in Babylonia. Cyrus composed it, or I should say the priests of the Babylonian god Marduk composed it on Cyrus's behalf for distribution to a Babylonian audience. But there are also sources from Armenia. Cyrus factors heavily in the Armenian national epic, and he's spoken of very positively there. And there's interestingly—
Is that independent of the Old Testament?
Also independent, yes.
I mean,
also,
this may be obvious answers to my questions.
No. Absolutely. That too is independent. And then also independent, this is very interesting, I think, is that there is a pre-Buddhist map discovered in Tibet, which probably goes back. It's a more recent replica of an ancient precursor that probably goes back to the 3rd century BC. And it has Cyrus's tomb fixated at the center of the world, and it's the House of the Sun is what it's called.
In Tibet?
Yes.
Did the Persian Empire spread that far?
Not that we know of, but they may have had relations.
Yeah.
And in fact, some Soviet scholars believe that the pre-Buddhist religion of Tibet was primarily Mithraic, meaning it centered around the worship of the god Mithra, who is the Iranian god of the sun and of the oath, and that this religion may have entered Tibet during the Persian period.
You mentioned Cyrus Cylinder.
Yes.
When was that discovered?
The Cyrus Cylinder was discovered in the 1870s by Hormoz Rassam, who was an archaeologist working for the British Museum.
Were they looking for something related to the Persian Empire and Cyrus the Great? Is this after Western academics are bringing this story back?
Well, very loosely, yes. They were at that time excavating the site of ancient Babylon. And that's where they discovered the cylinder. And there's some dispute as to whether the cylinder was discovered near or beneath the foundations of the main temple of the god Marduk, which would have been a fitting place for it to have been deposited, or near the perimeter wall of Babylon. And in fact, in the cylinder inscription itself, mention is made of Cyrus restoring part of that fortification.
Yeah. What does the cylinder say?
The cylinder is interesting because Cyrus, you have to keep in mind, was an Iranian. The Babylonians belonged to a totally different cultural background. Their ethnic background, they were Semitic, and they were more closely related than to the Arabs and also to the Hebrews. Cyrus, when he invades Babylon, he establishes very good relations with the local clergy, which at that time was disenchanted with the ruling king. And so when Cyrus enters the country, what he does is he portrays himself as a native ruler. He adopts the titulary of a native Babylonian king. He pays homage to the local gods. And then what he does
is this what he did everywhere?
As far as we know, yes.
I mean,
yes, this was his general policy. Now,
that's what we normally think of Alexander. Did Alexander pick up what Cyrus was doing?
Alexander is said to have had Cyrus as a role model.
Yeah.
And it would not surprise me if he deliberately mimicked or imitated some of Cyrus's pragmatic policies, and this was one of them. But yes, Cyrus portrays himself as a local Babylonian king in the Cyrus cylinder, but what's even more interesting is that toward the end of that inscription, what he talks about is that all these different groups that the Babylonians had taken into exile and all the different cult icons that the Babylonians had confiscated from their sanctuaries as a form of cult suppression, this was a way to keep their foreign subjects in line. Cyrus issues an edict authorizing their restoration. So all the exiled groups are now restored to their homelands. All the confiscated cult icons go back to their sanctuaries. And the sanctuaries, to the extent that they've been ravaged or dilapidated, are rebuilt. And so it's really remarkable for that time.
And important to understand the historic context that Cyrus was operating in is he came after the Assyrian Empire, which was considered a very brutal empire.
Exactly. It was a very efficient empire in terms of its bureaucracy. It had a strong ideology of kingship, and these were elements of it that Cyrus would incorporate into his own imperial apparatus and ideology. But as opposed to the Assyrians, Cyrus did not use calculated acts of terror and violence to keep his subjects in line, and this is what the Assyrians did. They had no qualms about engaging in mass murder if it served their purposes. They implemented population deportation. This meant that when they conquered a place, they would transplant part of the local population to a different region of their empire and then replace them from peoples drawn from other provinces. And the idea was that by shuffling everyone around within their state, they would break the national identity of the different peoples over which they ruled. And this is very different than what Cyrus and his successors did. During the Persian period, the national identity of the various subject nations was in fact nurtured. And one manifestation of this was the tendency during the Persian period for the different subject nations to bring their laws together. And back then, law meant something more than just a statute. It was really just a assembly, if you would, of major cultural institutions. And this had to do with the manner in which the Persians ran their empire, which was each nation was to be governed according to its own laws. And the most famous manifestation of this, of which we know, is the case of the Jews. In 450 BC, Cyrus's great-grandson sends the priest scholar Ezra to Jerusalem with orders to compile the Law of Moses and to educate the people in it. And the outcome of this is most likely the canonization of the first five books of the Old Testament. This would be the Torah or the Pentateuch.
So there's a strong connection there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's something that's overlooked nowadays, unfortunately, because there are tensions between Iran and between Iran and Israel. But if you go back historically, the two countries have there have been extensive periods when their interests have been aligned.
Cyrus Cylinder is in cuneiform?
It's in Akkadian cuneiform. Yes. Akkadian is the language of ancient Babylonia.
Yeah. And you can read cuneiform, but Persian cuneiform.
Yes, old Persian cuneiform, not the Akkadian form. And I have to say that old Persian, if you're going to learn a cuneiform language, that's supposed to be the easiest one.
You learned it by what, the age 13?
By age 13, yes, through the assistance of a family friend who is the professor at Harvard University, Richard Nelson Fry, who actually passed away about a month ago, yes.
Cuneiform, it's not an alphabet.
Well, the old Persian one was, yes. It was mostly alphabetical. There were some consonant and vowel combinations had their own signs. So there were 36 letters in there, or symbols, I should say. And there were a few ideograms, too, for frequently used terms, such as king, land, earth, and God.
Uh-huh. And then this is the precursor to Persian?
Well, the language is, yes, the language would be the grandfather language of Farsi. But cuneiform writing actually began to decline during the Achaemenid period. In fact, most scholars believe that old Persian cuneiform was used only for monumental inscriptions. For much of the day-to-day record-keeping, the tendency during the course of the two centuries of Achaemenid rule was to transition toward Aramaic, which was written essentially in a cursive script, which was more conducive for writing on parchment. And there was a shift at that time between writing on clay tablets, and you would use the wedges for writing the cuneiform, to writing on parchment, papyrus, if you would.
Yeah. Again, you learned this by the age of 13. We should tell our listeners that you're not a professor.
No, I'm not.
Teaching this. You're actually a lawyer.
I am. And I urge the listeners not to hold that against me.
But your profession has nothing actually to do, except for maybe in some abstract ways, but nothing directly to do with your research on this. And you've been researching this all your life? What is it that drove this to you?
More or less. Well, I'm really a first-generation Iranian, meaning although I was born in London, as an infant, I was in Iran, and then we had to leave at the time of the revolution. And I came here, and there was always this weird sense of detachment within my family. And I should say that when I first came to America, and this story may be similar for many Iranians who left their country at that time, it took several years for everyone to get settled in. So for a while, living in the same house, it was me, I had three sisters, my parents, I had three grandparents. There were cameos made occasionally by various aunts and uncles. And so the conversation normally around the dinner table focused on the old country, if you would. And as someone, as an Iranian American now, I'd heard about the place all my life, but I wasn't able to see it until, a few years ago. But because it was this, there's really the idea of this homeland, of this country, that's how I got interested in this at a very young age.
How did you do the research for the book and books that you're still writing?
It began, really when I was in the fifth grade. That's when I picked up my first copy of Herodotus.
I started reading Herodotus
in the fifth grade, and then Xenophon, and I just absorbed it. And it was something I was always so fascinated with that I was always looking to see what else is, what more is there out there that I can get my hands on and read.
Do you have study groups with other fifth graders?
No. Not in this stuff.
How about college graduates?
No, if anything, this stuff always detracted from the actual coursework I had to perform. But what happened was the corpus of material that I used, that I you know, that I've used as sources for this book and also for the future books, it's expanded. You know, at first it may have started with secondary literature, and then it went to the Greek and, you know, the Greek and Roman classics. And then from there, the cuneiform inscriptions, and then from there, the legendary traditions, the epics, the Iranian epics, if you mm-hmm. would, and then the translations. I don't know Armenian, but the translations of the Armenian epics. And so there's a vast amount of material. And unfortunately, because the Iranians themselves in antiquity did not record their history, you really have to draw upon all of this. And then also there's linguistic evidence, which can be telling, and there's archaeological evidence also. And so you have to tell the story of Cyrus in the level of depth and detail that I wanted to do in this book, you have to draw upon all of this. Because if you just go by one line of evidence, so to speak, one set of material, you're not going to get the full picture.
What drives you to tell this story? And I guess what I'm trying to get at is it just that this is important history that, one, you want to know, and then, two, you want to be able to share with others? Or, and maybe and or, three, is there an important story here that is important for us today, to understand today, significant today?
Well, I think it's both. And I'll begin by addressing the first aspect of that question, which is that when you read the classical literature, for example, it's the names of three great leaders and nation builders that consistently stand out. There's Cyrus, there's Alexander, and there's Caesar. Cyrus came first in time of the three. He was, as we talked about earlier, he was a role model for Alexander. He may have influenced Caesar's actions to an extent as well, but he's obviously the least well understood. Mm-hmm. At the same time,
do you think that's because he comes from the East?
There is certainly an element of that. That he's not part of the Western historical canon. You know, it's interesting. I would imagine one can be a European, say, from Germany. But when you read about Caesar's conquest, when you read about Alexander, it's almost the sentiment. The impression I have is that the sentiment is almost that they're reading about their own grandfathers, if you would. Cyrus was always a respected figure, but he was operating on the peripheries of Western civilization.
But in the ancient world, I mean, you have the Persian Empire and you have
exactly.
the Greek and the Roman Empire. And there was all, I mean, they knew of each other very well.
They knew of each other very well. But what's interesting, again, is that, you know, Western cultural identity, to you know, at least in the traditional sense, it really the formative historical event was the Persian Wars, the wars between Cyrus's grandson Xerxes and the mainland Greeks. And in that context, the Persians were always the other. And so the misconception, I think, is that the Persians, unlike the Greeks who have left democracy, have not left a meaningful historical legacy for the world today. But that would be globalism, I think. Again, the Persians had the same – the Persian Empire really came up with a blueprint for how you could bring peoples of different cultures together and how you could keep them – essentially within a single community. And this was something that was borrowed from them later by the Greeks during the Hellenistic period following the conquest of Alexander, and from then passed on to the Romans. But I think history, what's interesting about it, especially, you know, when you go back several thousands of years, is that it provides a good blueprint to guide us in the future. And one of the things that Cyrus did that I think is very useful right now was that he paid a great deal of attention when he was interacting with another culture or another people, he paid a great deal of attention, him and his officers, to learn about that people, learn about the issues that matter to them, and try to relate to them in terms of their own religious beliefs and customs and cultural values. And that's a lesson that I think statesmen today can glean. I mean, you consider, for example, what I told you about Cyrus when he invaded Babylonia, mm-hmm. how he really reached out and tried to present himself as a native prince, as a native king, an upholder of native values. Compare that to the last invasion of the same region, which occurred about a decade ago. And, you know, the turmoil there, it's still, I'm not saying that a few nice words would have made a difference here or there, but I think that it's fairly apparent that the proper homework had not been done before going in there. And so that's why one has the mess one has now. But, you know, Cyrus, again, was someone who was very well prepared, and he had this knack. I think he had this knack for relating to people. He had his pulse on the situation in a very acute manner, and so he knew how to deal with others.
We are in conversation with Reza Zarghami, and we are talking about his book, Discovering Cyrus, the Persian Conqueror, Astride the Ancient World. Again, it's book one of Iran's Age of Empire. And you're going to also write about Darius. Darius or Darius? I've heard it.
I grew up hearing it Darius, uh-huh. But now it's always Darius when I hear it. So Darius is probably phonetically closer to the old Persian.
Darius.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So then Xerxes.
Darius and Xerxes will treat as a pair, as a unit.
Were these successor kings?
Yeah, Darius was.
Did it go in this order, those three? No one in between?
No. Cyrus the Great was Cyrus II in the family tree. He was followed by his son Cambyses II, who ruled for 7 years. And he was a very powerful king. He conquered Egypt, but he was very much into centralizing power. And so he had a bad reputation because he disenfranchised to an extent the nobility, the Persian nobles at that time. And so he was overthrown under mysterious circumstances in 522 BC. And then the next king of the dynasty is Darius I, who was Cyrus's cousin, distant cousin. But then later when he won the throne, what he did to enhance
his... He won the throne.
Oh, yes, yes.
It's just not given.
It wasn't just given to him. There was a it's an interesting story. They say when Cambyses was killed, toward the end of his reign, I should say, Cambyses, before he had gone off to conquer Egypt, he had put to death his brother because he was fearful that the brother would make a move against him when he was away from the heartland of the empire. But he kept it a secret because the brother was very popular. And so he goes to Egypt for 3 years, and then a magi, this would be a priest, comes up and says, I'm the brother, and the people all believe him. Hmm. And so they flock to his side, and Cambyses, on the way back to confront the pretender, dies. Now, he dies whether of an accidental wound or a self-inflicted wound in the terms of suicide, no one knows. And in fact, a lot of scholars doubt this story today. And there's a power struggle, and then the person who emerges victorious is Darius. And then when Darius becomes king, the first thing he does in order to enhance his legitimacy is he marries every living female descendant of Cyrus, two of Cyrus's daughters and one of his granddaughters.
He marries them all.
Yes, and so he becomes Cyrus's son-in-law, but after the fact.
And is this – so polygamy – is acceptable? Is this acceptable for everyone during this time, or
it was acceptable?
The king of Persia. There,
it was acceptable for everyone at that time within Iran. Uh-huh. One of the Greek geographers tells us that among the Medes, who were people closely related to the Persians, the rule was that if you're a man of means, you should have at least five wives. The Persian kings had multiple wives. They often married for diplomatic reasons. These were diplomatic marriages, but the number of wives and concubines increased greatly toward the end of the empire. Once Cyrus himself, for example, only had, as far as we know, he had five children. Darius had six or seven wives, but some of the later kings had one concubine for each night of the year. At the same time, we found, archaeologists, I should say, have found records from Persepolis, which was one of the capitals of Darius's empire. And it shows that the royal women, however, had a great deal of autonomy. And some of them had their own estates, which they actively managed. They could travel around freely. So it was a different, it was a polygamous society. It was a patriarchal society, for sure. But at the same time, the women had a fair amount of freedom, and they had autonomy, and they had responsibility as well.
Was the religion during this time Zoroastrianism?
You know, Professor Richard Fry, from whom who guided me in learning cuneiform, he had a saying that anyone who really tries to characterize ancient Iranian religion from this time, all the scholars who've attempted to do so and come up with an overarching definition and characterization, they all end up going insane at the end due to the lack of evidence and the nitpicking. But it is my belief that all the Achaemenid kings, again, this is the dynasty to which Cyrus belonged, from Cyrus to the last king of the dynasty, Darius III, they practiced Zoroastrianism. And it was because of their patronage of that religion that it began to expand and it began to spread within the Iranian plateau. I believe, my own belief is that before that, Zoroastrianism was very much a minority religion. The majority of Iranians followed a pagan religion, which was really focused on nature worship, if you would.
Now, Zoroastrianism has been called a precursor to monotheism, to Judaism, and the rest of the monotheistic religions.
Yes.
Do you agree with that?
I'm not sure that I would call it a precursor to Judaism per se, but I would say that there's a great amount of evidence to suggest that it had a very profound influence upon Judaism and that this influence helped transform Judaism into a truly monotheistic religion. And Zoroastrianism itself is technically it's a polytheistic religion, but it does have monotheistic tendencies. It exalts the one good god. His name is Ahura Mazda, the Lord of Wisdom. And Ahura Mazda has an enemy, and that's Angermainyu, that's the devil, essentially. And the whole purpose of the creation of the material world in Zoroastrianism is to lure the devil and the forces of darkness. This is the forces of the lie, from an unassailable place into an arena where they can be eradicated once and for all at the end of time. And the Zoroastrians believed that this victory of good over evil at the end of time would be brought about by a human savior who would be born to a virgin mother. So you could stop me if you think this sounds familiar. And in fact, the first unequivocally monotheistic description of Yahweh in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, occurs in the writings of 2nd Isaiah, who was a propagandist for Cyrus. And he always intertwines his praise of Yahweh as the creator of the earth and the heavens and everything in between with his praise of Cyrus. And so there's good reason to think on that basis alone, as well as on the fact that 2nd Isaiah's utterances about Yahweh seem to resemble the utterances of the Persian kings regarding Ahura Mazda, the Zoroastrian god, that there may have been some influence from Zoroastrianism to Judaism at that time, and that this carried on during the Persian period and even afterward, and that Christian theology has a degree of debt to Zoroastrianism.
Is this where we begin to see, do we know of any other religions? You'll forgive me if I'm even going outside your own expertise by incorporating all religions here, but is this where we begin to see, as you mentioned, a good god and a bad god? A bad god being a devil.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, these developments were in line with greater philosophical developments at this time. The period from 800 to 200 BC has been termed the Axial Age by Carl Jaspers. And what that term signifies is that religions as a whole suddenly began to shift away, you know, the focus began to shift away from ritual into this exploration of ethics.
Around the purpose. 500 BC.
Exactly.
You have Confucius.
Exactly.
Buddhism.
You have Confucius. Exactly. You have Confucius in China. You have the Buddha in India. You have some of the pre-Socratic philosophers, and then Socrates himself would be an axial figure. You have certainly some of the biblical prophets as well. Jasper's theory was that this was independent evolution all along these different cultures, and that the reason was that it was a common reaction to a common problem, and that was the instability, social instability brought about by constant warfare and internecine strife. But I also think that there was an element, this process, I think Jaspers may have overlooked essentially the ability of the Persian Empire, the role played by the Persian Empire, which embraced many of these different cultures and which affected the ones that may have been just outside its zone of political control, and really opened the channels for the transmission of ideas if you would. And I think religious ideas at the time, religion was very important in society.
Reza Zarghami, as we move to wrap up here, again, this book is on Cyrus the Great, who in history is seen as this powerful and mostly good leader, as you've pointed out. And then Darius and then Xerxes. Xerxes doesn't get the same type of reverence that Cyrus does, at least in popular culture. You know, I think of movies.
The 300 movies.
The 300 movie, yeah.
Well, Xerxes may not deserve this. I mean, he may not deserve it the same way that Cyrus did or that Darius did. And the fact of the matter is that Xerxes came to power. Xerxes essentially was born in the purple. And what that means is that his father was already an established person. The empire was already there. He came to power like anyone would in that situation, I think, with a set of preconceived notions of what's acceptable, what's right, what's wrong. He may have been more prejudiced. He may not have had to deal firsthand during his formative years necessarily with he may not have known, and let's just put it this way, he may not have had a firsthand experience with the political background policies.
He's portrayed as sort of towards the end of the collapse of the Persian Empire, a man who was involved in excesses. A very common story we know from many different civilizations.
Right, exactly. So I would say he didn't know the cultural background to the policies that his father and his grandfather Cyrus had. And he was born in the purple. At that time, there was, as is common with these monarchies, once they're established, then the focus becomes to entrench it. And the monarch takes on this larger-than-life persona. And a lot of this had happened under his predecessors, but this is what Xerxes knew. He didn't know he had no familiarity with, say, the tribal period when the Persian king ruled as a first among equals. So he concentrated power. He was very extravagant because the extravagance is really a manifestation of that power. He may have been more prejudiced in his outlook, say, for example, with religions. And he was also, and this comes across in Herodotus, very interestingly enough, he was very much burdened by the legacy of his predecessors. Classic story of the child of born into an overachieving family. You know, his father was an excellent king. He was really an outstanding person. He had to overcome so many difficulties just to become king. And then his grandfather was Cyrus, who founded the empire, of course, and had this amazing reputation. And Xerxes was burdened by this. And he felt he had to live up to their standards. And that's why Herodotus ascribes one of the reasons as to why he took the invasion of Greece, undertook the invasion of Greece in 480 BC, which maybe from a military or tactical standpoint was risky. He did it because he felt he had to live up to the standards set by his ancestors, who were not afraid to go on a distant campaign, who were not afraid to return an injustice. And from the Persian standpoint, that's what it was. The Athenians had invaded Persian territory. They had burned a city, a major provincial capital, and now it was incumbent upon the king to go and punish them. Because if he did not do that, then the monarchy would be exposed in some manner. And so he went.
Seem weak,
exactly. And so he went and he did this and he was defeated. And the classical portrayal, at least, is that this had a psychological effect on him. He became inward-looking. He retreated after this traumatic experience of the defeat. He retreated into the harem, surrounded himself with his wives and concubines, and eventually he was assassinated.
But what's interesting about history is history is political.
Right.
It sets out a narrative for today in a political discourse, is that what we're not normally told about this war is that Xerxes felt like he had to respond to an attack that happened on Persia first.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because I think in just common, again, movies or whatever it may be, it's oftentimes seen as Xerxes is the aggressor.
Absolutely. He felt the need that he had to punish the Athenians for what they had done during the reign of his father, They had assisted the Ionians. These were Greeks living along the coast of Asia Minor. They had risen up in rebellion against the Persians, and the Athenians had assisted them, and they had burned the provincial capital of Sardis. And so he felt very much compelled. But there's an important lesson in this too, which one shouldn't necessarily overstep the boundaries. Because what happened was, by overstepping the boundaries, by invading into invading Europe, by trying to conquer the mainland Greeks, by planting the seeds of this animosity, Xerxes really facilitated the eventual downfall of his own empire, because this, he brought, first of all, he brought the Greeks together. And although that alliance that was formed in 480 BC did not last, it set a blueprint for the Greeks in the future to know that, yes, we can come together as a people. He set the precedent for the Persians to be viewed as the enemies, and he brought Persia into the Greek world, so to speak. And the outcome of this was that in 330 BC, Alexander the Great of Macedon, the son of Philip of Macedon, carried out his father's plan to wage a crusade against Persia, and he conquered the Persian Empire.
Reza Zarghami, I've enjoyed our conversation very much. Thank you for being here. Maybe we'll, one day we'll have you come back to talk about what you do in your 9-to-5.
Thank you very much. I look forward to it.
Reza Zarghami has been our guest. Again, the book is Discovering Cyrus, The Persian Conqueror Astride the Ancient World.